Hi, Grace Tame here. You might know me as the 2021 Australian of the Year or quote unquote difficult woman, but did you know I'm also autistic? It took me a long time to get diagnosed, and sadly, that's true for a lot of women. I want to know why that's the case. That's why I'm taking over Ladies We Need to Talk for a series called Autistic AF. Find it by searching Ladies We Need to Talk on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Triple J podcast.
As soon as women's either financial means or status surpassed that of the man they were dating or seeing, suddenly these negative responses started to show up.
Hello, my friend, Dee Salmon with you for the Hookup Podcast, where we talk all things love, sex, dating, and relationships. If you're new here, hello. Every Tuesday, basically, Pip, my co-host, and I delve into a topic that either you've inspired, maybe you've DM'd us on our Instagram at Triple J The Hookup, and you need help with something, or it's a debate you want us to unpack, or it's something that we see everyone's talking about online. And that's what basically happened this week. So an article went viral from The Guardian. It says, single women are buying more houses, the men they are dating are not responding well. And Pip and I posted this on the Instagram, and we basically said, can anyone relate to this? The article talks about the fact that so many women who are ambitious, buying houses, you know, doing well education or career-wise, are finding that when they're dating, if they're dating men, there's a bit of a tension point there. Like, guys are either not responding well, or they're put off by that, or they're intimidated or jealous or whatever it is. So we wanted to do an episode on this and see if there's something that you've noticed in your own life. And so many of you told us that you have. So we unpacked it, we spoke to you, we heard your stories. And now I thought for this episode, why not chat to the journalist and the author behind the article that inspired this whole topic for us. So you're about to hear from Stephanie O'Connell. She is an award-winning writer. She's an author and she's a speaker, journalist. Her latest book is called The Ambition Penalty. And so I was really lucky to jump on Zoom. She's in New York. I was really lucky to jump on Zoom with her at 5 a.m. in the morning her time. So generous of her to make this work. And yeah, it was such an interesting chat. We spoke about her article and what inspired it, what she was hearing from all of the women she was interviewing. We spoke about a lot of the research and the studies that she looked into, what some of the experts were saying in psychology around this tension that's very hetero and gendered, and also what she's learned, you know, writing about ambitious women who are dating men and how that kind of impacts their love lives. She also gives us some advice at the end about, you know, if this is something that you can relate to, what should you do if you still want to find love but you don't want to shrink yourself, and also what she predicts will happen in the future. Will guys who are dating women still be intimidated by their success? Who knows? It is such a fascinating chat. So yeah, let's get into it. Stephanie, I'm so excited to chat to you. Thank you so much for coming on The Hookup.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your book, The Ambition Penalty, whilst does talk about relationships, focuses largely on women and ambition and money in the cultural context of the workplace, right? Like, you talk about how women can face a systemic ambition penalty, you know, the professional, financial, and personal costs put on them when they pursue career growth or ambition in the workplace. And in this article that you wrote for The Guardian, you focus on ambitious women, but how they've been experiencing dating and relationships when it comes to buying property, which I can't wait to unpack with you. But why was this something that you wanted to write about and explore? How did it come about?
So I had been writing about women in the workplace managing their money for a really long time. And what I saw covering personal finance was that women could do all of the quote unquote right things and follow all of the correct steps and still not get the same outcomes as their male peers. And so it struck me that there was this disconnect between the advice women were getting and the outcomes they were receiving. And as I started to report on how the very same ambition that men could implement to get ahead at work, to access higher pay, to get more opportunity, how that same ambition was weaponized against women, used to label them too difficult, too hard to work with, not a good fit, not a team player, and ways that held back their opportunity and their pay and their advancement, I started to see that this was not just a workplace phenomenon. This was a world phenomenon, something women were were experiencing well beyond the workplace, in their homes, in their communities, among their families, in ways that really puts pressure constantly on women to want less, to shrink, to contain their ambition rather than have it celebrated, supported, and rewarded.
So what were you hearing from women, Stephanie, when it came to their love lives? Like, what? How did that extend to then what they noticed when it came to buying property and the kind of guys they were dating and the reactions that they were getting when they disclosed that they were homeowners?
Yes. So this story specifically, where women who are homeowners were going on dates with men and finding that these men would suddenly either shut down and withdraw from the conversation or kind of get aggressive and really a little bit combative and hostile as soon as the men found out that the women owned their homes. And it came about because I was interviewing women for my book and I was researching the way ambition was being weaponized against women in their home lives, in their dating lives, and how that really stuck with them. And in these interviews, it wasn't just becoming a property owner that triggered this kind of withdrawal or hostility against them. It was really kind of any metric of traditional success, whether it was income, whether it was job status, whether it was something like owning a home, a major financial milestone. As soon as women's either financial means or status, quote unquote, surpassed that of the man they were dating or seeing or trying to date, suddenly these negative responses started to show up in that environment. And in this piece, I spoke to women who had men say things like, well, I guess if you're going to buy a house, what am I supposed to do for you? What's a guy supposed to do for you? Well, good luck finding someone else when you're just little Miss Independent. And it was not just that they were facing backlash from these men, but these men would actively put them down, almost to kind of putting these women in their place in a very patriarchal sense of the word. And I think one of the things that struck me as I was reporting the piece was just how much the women were really responding, not by saying, okay, well, I'm going to shrink my aspirations or sell my house, but instead saying, oh, if this is the landscape of dating in a modern context, I don't want to be part of it.
Yeah. What was really fascinating was some research you spoke about in the piece was that despite women earning less than men on average, this was data from the National Association of Realtors 2025 profile of home buyers and sellers. But they found that single women report a greater willingness to make financial sacrifices to prioritize their home buying goals. So 41% reported spending less on entertainment, vacations, clothing, and other non-essential goods compared with 31% of single men. Did you find that, women's priorities are shifting now, whereas maybe previously we might have been, growing up on Disney and fairy tales and rom-coms, like we might have seen our roles as women to try and find a partner if we were dating men. But now that's starting to shift and we have kind of other goals and things that we're looking for, like buying property or moving up the career ladder.
Yeah. So one of the things that's very clear is that women are not necessarily opting out of partnership, but they are not willing to sacrifice their other goals for the sake of partnership. And that was a theme that came up when I was interviewing some of the experts for this piece, was really pointing out how in a very recent past in which women did not have equal opportunity to access things like financing, lending to purchase homes, to make enough money to be able to buy them, women were really dependent on men in ways that meant they kind of had to trade off any other kinds of aspirations or standards they might have in order to be seen as desirable. So if you literally can't own your own home without a male cosigner, then part of getting access to a home isn't just finances, it's about making yourself palatable to a man. And so in that landscape, there was just a different standard of priorities for how you had to, what trade-offs you were willing to make. And I think we have not reckoned with the fact that as much as we know we're in a different landscape, there hasn't been a reckoning with how this changes the dynamics of dating, because people don't understand just how much heterosexual relationships have really been about trade-offs that women had to make, not that they wanted to make. And so we have this language of give and take around relationships, like, well, you get this and I get this. But that was very much an uneven trade in a way that I think we haven't really recognized until recently, as more and more of these stories are coming up, where women are just pursuing their ambitions the way men do, and yet it is being seen as a problem. And it's only a problem in a world in which we've all been conditioned into thinking that, oh, of course women should sacrifice what they really want and what they really want to achieve for themselves. And so I think in the data that what we are seeing now is that women are organizing their lives around their independent ambitions in ways that they are not waiting to prioritize those other goals until they find a partner. So if they want to buy a house, if they want to have even a child, they have a willingness to do those things alone. And men, on the other hand, are more likely to hold off and wait until they're partnered and wait until like all those other relational pieces are in place before they make the financial priorities something they pursue.
That backlash that you are talking about when it comes to women telling guys, you know, and property could just be a part of, like you said, a bigger picture, which is what we spoke about on the hookup of quote unquote success, right? It's like career, it could be, yeah, wealth, it could be education, maybe you've got a PhD. What do you think the tension is when women disclose this or guys realize that about someone and they either have this like, yeah, really mean reaction or kind of try and put them down, or maybe they, you know, ghost or disappear or actually not interested anymore. What do you think is going on their behalf?
So the researchers call this a pattern of male backlash. So I just want to say that all of these kind of anecdotal things that we're sharing are also evidenced in the data. This is not a one-off thing. This isn't just some guys behaving badly. This is a well-documented pattern in which this is not uncommon, where men are lashing out or withdrawing from women who outpace them on these traditional markers of success, like income or wealth or home ownership. And so what the researchers call is male backlash. And that is where men lash out like this because it's a way of reasserting dominance. When you think about this through a framework of power and very patriarchal ideas that men should have greater access to power and resources and women should submit, if women outpace men on those metrics that men really associate with their own masculinity and their own sense of identity, then asserting their power physically or even verbally through kind of lashing out becomes a way of kind of reasserting that hierarchy of dominance through another way. And we see this all the time, you know, even things like harassment and abuse, those are motivated by power. Sexual assault is motivated by power. People think, you know, it's about trying to act out some kind of fantasy, but always the research shows us that it's really about establishing dominance. And when people feel like they're, men feel rather, that they are kind of like not in that dominant position anymore, they'll find ways to assert it through other means. And so that is really clear, I think, in the dating market now, and I think in broader trends that we're seeing with the rise of kind of manosphere content and a real doubling down on ideals of masculinity that are about, you know, physical strength, economic status, and kind of asserting yourself through these other markers of dominance.
You spoke about in the article that a growing body of data shows that men engage in higher rates of infidelity and emotional and physical abuse when outpaced by female partners in traditional markers of wealth and status, such as income. I was shook by this. Like, obviously, like you said, I know that there's research behind, you know, this tension and the fact that they, you know, might feel uncomfortable or intimidated or try and, you know, create dominance. But the fact that, yeah, research shows that they're actually taking that, like you said, a step further, and it's like higher rates of infidelity in emotional and physical abuse. What are you seeing when it comes to not even just reactions in dating or on apps, but actually in relationships? Because we spoke to a lot of listeners who said that they went into that relationship maybe on equal footing, or maybe the guy had more control or more quote unquote, you know, traditional markers of success, but then she kind of outpaced him, and that was when all this tension and maybe even, you know, emotional abuse started to occur. What have you found from speaking to women about that dynamic shift that happens in relationships?
You know, one of the most interesting things about this to me is when you look at the data, women's income in and of itself, as it goes up, really benefits women and their relationships. It improves their own well-being and it improves their relationship satisfaction. And that's just because, you know, income makes it easier to live your life. You know, when you have greater access to financial resources, it can reduce stress. That benefits not only women, it benefits their partners, it benefits their dependents, it benefits the whole household. Where the negative reactions from men are coming up in ways that put stress on the relationship, hurt women's relationship satisfaction, and cause this real, these real negative outcomes, like you said, higher rates of infidelity, higher rates of emotional abuse that women are being targeted with, higher rates of even physical violence against these women, is when women's income outpaces their male partners. So if they earn more than half of the household income. And what's really interesting to me is that it doesn't matter what that number actually is. It's not the income itself. It's only how much more it is relative to men. And so in this paper studying emotional abuse and physical abuse, for example, in heterosexual relationships, women were 35% more likely to experience physical violence from male partners when they were financial breadwinners, and 20% more likely to experience emotional abuse. And that pattern held up and down the income level. So among high earners and low earners, when I talk about these things, there's often this very misogynistic assumption that, well, if a woman earns a lot of money, there's something fundamentally wrong with her. She must be incredibly selfish. She must be a bad partner. She must be ignoring her man in ways that kind of justify this mistreatment. And what the data show is that the only thing that is the problem here is the way, at least statistically, is the way men are responding to women earning more. It's not their incomes in and of themselves that are creating the problem. It's the response when men believe they should always have more of it. And so I just think that's such an interesting disconnect when we see women's incomes going up. Everybody's really benefit. Everyone's benefiting. It's just when it gets like, okay, well, if you're suddenly making more than me, that's when we're getting the problem. Well, then that's not a me problem. That's a you problem.
It's completely linked to the ego, isn't it? It's about what you said, that power and that dominance. What do you think about the current state of heterosexuality? This is something that we've covered quite a bit on The Hookup. I know you quoted a study in your article, the Ipsos one, around 31% of Gen Z men thinking that a woman should obey their husband. You have obviously been studying and writing about this for a long time now. What do you think about the current climate with the manosphere and these kind of ideas that seem to be really coming to the forefront when we think about that data, like that 31% of Gen Z in the younger generation?
I think it's a crisis. I think the state of heterosexual relationships have probably always been in crisis in ways that we never reckoned with, because of what I said before about like how much of economic dependence by design really was something that forced women into trade-offs that we just would never expect of men. And I don't think we have ever really had a moment where we, as much as we might recognize it in theory, but in practice to reckon with how much those relationships were inequitable is not something that I think we've really come to terms with. The amount of sacrifice that women have been expected to make and continue to be expected to make. I've talked about in my book, just like the level of household inequality in heterosexual relationships is astounding, just how little that has changed over decades and decades, even as women have increased their workforce participation, outpace men in markers of wealth, status, and income. Even when women earn more than their male peers, they're still carrying so much more of the unpaid household labor, of the childcare, so much more of the sacrifices in ways that really hurt women's well-being. And so I think what we're kind of coming to terms with now is how little has changed in terms of the expectations put upon men in relationships and how they show up, even as women are now carrying both the paid labor and all of the unpaid labor that they did in the past. In fact, time use status shows that women, again, even when they outpace their male peers on income, are spending more time than their mothers did in childcare. And so, like, we are seeing just enormous pressures on women in ways that I think really reveal just how broken heterosexual relationships are today. And so I think people who are dating, especially younger women who might be seeing, you know, women who are my age and midlife, kind of in the trenches of having young children, being in their mid-career, really struggling through these things, they're looking at this and saying, if that's what it takes, I don't want it. And I think they're right.
It is such a fascinating time because I think, yeah, like you said, this is something that's been ongoing for so long. But now, like what you talk about in the article, women are prioritizing other things. And so we're at this tension point, right, where you don't need love and you don't need a male partner to survive. But so many women want that. What's your advice? Because someone that I spoke to, Dr. Caroline, she is an aerospace engineer. She has a PhD. I spoke to her 4 years ago, and she basically came to us with this theory where she realized that when she was on dating apps, she wouldn't get any matches, had an aerospace engineer in her bio. But then when she took that off, she would get so many matches. And we had a check-in with her 4 years later. She's been single now for 7 years, and she said, it hasn't gotten any better. She's just bought property with her best friend. She's just, you know, as much as she really desperately wants a partner and to be a wife one day and to be a mother, she just doesn't really see that on the horizon for her. And she doesn't want to, I guess, shrink herself or sacrifice her achievements in her career and in just in life in general. What is your advice for women who are grappling with that tension of really wanting love but not knowing what to do about it because they don't want to change their bios or shrink their careers?
I just want to say I empathize so much. Like, that's a really real struggle, and I know how much it's painful. I spoke to so many women who are in the same position, but I do think she's on the right track with building a life she loves with people she loves. Anyway, in other forms, I think we have valorized heterosexual romantic partnership in ways that it is the pinnacle of love, of family, but family is many things. Love is very expansive. It can look like so much and in so many different formats. And I love seeing people reimagine what that love can look like in ways that expand them instead of shrink them. And so I have become a huge proponent, and this is true for people in relationships too, of really building your, not just your independent ambitions, but also the community that shows up for you and supports you and champions you. And it might not be a romantic partner. It might just be a group of really close friends and family members and neighbors. And I just think there are much better ways to structure our lives, again, whether or not we're in romantic partnership, in ways that really, I think, confront the idea that, you know, two people, man and woman, are like the ultimate model of achievement when it comes to relationships. Because, you know, I have to say, like, looking around at the people I know who are in those relationships and who've been in those relationships for a long time, they're not very happy. And I think it's not because there's something wrong with them. I think it's something wrong with the model. It's something wrong with the model of saying like, okay, this is where you get all of love and family. And then like everything else is secondary. I think it's just not sustainable. It puts too much pressure on a single person. It puts too much pressure on a couple. It winds up reinforcing a lot of the negative dynamics of the culture that they live within, as we are speaking about here, like these expectations of like provider protector, which are really expectations of inequality. And so I think as much as we can, thinking more expansively about love and family. And then if we do meet somebody, they will fit into that. But we won't feel like we have to compromise ourselves when that happens because we are already so full. And I know that's easier said than reckoned with and accepted, but it is something that I wish we were talking about 20 years ago, because I do think it would have served both men and women better.
Do you think that things will change in the future in regards to that intimidation or threat that men are feeling towards women's success? Do you think this is something that eventually they might realize, hey, if we want to be, you know, in relationships, if we want to feel loved and we want the benefits that come from those heterosexual relationships, that they will have to? Or do you think this is something that we, like you said, we've dealt with for so long and it will be a struggle for many years to come?
I think it's going to be a struggle for a while, but I do think it will change because things always change, not necessarily in ways that we can predict. So I think there will be some change. I can't say what it will be. What I do see that I think is a little bit dispiriting is the extent to which the attitudes rarely change over the course of a lifetime. So once you've basically adopted a model of relationships that's really predicated on like, well, men should have more of the access to financial resources and women should basically compromise themselves and serve themselves in ways that support men's ambitions, it's really hard to break out of that model within the same person. It's much easier if you're talking about then a next generation. So one of the things I think about as a parent of a young child is, how am I modeling this? How am I modeling these dynamics for my child so that they understand that anyone who asks you to shrink yourself does not have your best interests at heart? And so even when, you know, we're dealing with kind of outside cultural forces that want to pull us into inequality as much as we might aspire to more equitable relationships, at the end of the day, you know, the school is still calling mom. The school is, the doctor still calls mom, right? Even if you're saying we're going to share this, the world outside of you is trying to pull you back into these very patriarchal roles. But I'm always pushing back against that because I think it's so, so important, as I think we're seeing now with Gen Z and how much the next generation winds up kind of carrying the legacy of the ugliest and worst parts of some of our older models of what it means to be a good woman or partner or wife or good husband or partner in ways that kind of are kind of toxic because they are really predicated on a model of dominance and submission instead of real partnership. And that's the tension that I think we have not reckoned with. And the data show us pretty clearly just how much that is something that is learned through observation. So children who are raised by parents who share household labor, for example, those boys become much more likely to share household labor in their own homes. When they become adults, they become much more likely to be married to women who are engaged in the paid labor force and who do well in the paid labor force. Daughters of mothers in the paid labor force also become much more likely to become married to equitable partners, and they become much more likely to also succeed in the paid labor force beyond their peers. So I think these, we talk about them as kind of logistical things like income, things like household labor, division of labor, expectations, but these are really expectations of power. And our ideas of power and gender roles are still incredibly, incredibly patriarchal in ways that I think will take a lot of work to reckon with. But I think in the meantime, it's great to opt out of them. And if we can find ways of not sacrificing the things we want from our relationships and from love, even if we opt out of these kind of unequal institutions, that's a great thing. You know, people finding other ways of building community, finding other people to buy homes with, maybe finding other people to start families with. I think that's wonderful. I think like we have kind of adopted, women are adopting this model of pursuing their ambitions independently, whether they're partnered or not. And I don't think we should limit that to finances. I think we should expand that to love too, because love can be many things.
Stephanie, you are such a wealth of knowledge. Honestly, I have loved this chat so much. Thank you. And obviously your book, The Ambition Penalty, is where people can find out so much more and probably in so much more depth as well. But where else can people find some more of your work?
Sure. So yes, the book is available wherever you get your books, The Ambition Penalty. I also have a newsletter called Too Ambitious on Substack. And I'm on social media at Stephanie O'Connell, where I talk a lot about these dynamics. So you can follow me there.
Amazing. We'll add all of those links as well into the show notes. Stephanie, thank you so much. And thank you for getting up at 5 a.m.
Thank you for having me.